Good morning. Thanks for coming. If people want to move up, you feel free, since there aren't very many people. So I guess the first thing I promised was to talk a little bit about card counting. So I'm going to do this in a way that's hopefully accessible to everybody and reasonably interesting, and also a little bit relevant to the class. Find some chalk. Okay, so let me just say really briefly what the rules of blackjack are. Actually, does anyone, maybe I'll just ask you, who wants to hear about the rules of blackjack? A little bit? Okay, so I'll do just a little bit about rules of blackjack. And I'm just curious, how many people have seen the movie 21? Okay, it's most. Okay, so I was not on that team, no. Okay, so the rules of blackjack really briefly. I'm sorry, I should have brought a deck of cards. I just didn't think about it that hard. So the rules of blackjack, you are dealt everyone at the table. Let's just pretend you're playing one-on-one with the dealer. So you get two cards, and the dealer gets one card face up, one card face down. And the object of the game is to, so the goal, I guess, is to get as close to 21 as possible without going over. Okay, the rules are different for a little bit different for the player and the dealer. The player looks at their two cards and the cards are worth the number on the cards. If they're numbers, all the face cards, meaning jacks, queens, and kings, are all worth 10. So if you get like a jack and a king, that's 20. That's pretty good. And an ace, you can choose to make it worth either 1 or 11, depending on which one would be better for your hand. So an ace and anything worth a 10, meaning a 10, jack, queen, or king, you'd think of as a perfect hand. That's a blackjack. Often referred to as blackjack, even though it may not involve a blackjack. But yeah, so that's sort of a perfect hand. So you'll win if you get that. So so that's the goal. And then if you have something less than 21, you have a choice as to whether or not you want to get another card or not. Right? So if you had 20, you wouldn't want to take another card. It'd be pretty stupid because the only way you could gain is if you got an ace, and anything else would put you over 21, and you'd lose automatically, right? And so your goal is to essentially have a better hand than the dealer at the end. If you had, like, maybe a 12, well, you know, anything, I guess. Well, so 12 is kind of a hard decision in many cases, because if you got anything worth a 10, that would give you 22, that would put you over. It's called busting, and you'd lose. But anything from, you know, an ace or anything from 2 through 9, you're going to improve your hand, okay? So one thing I should mention is that just a small amount of strategy is there's sort of no difference between a 12 and a 16 because the dealer has exact rules that they must follow. The dealer's rules are that if they have anything lower than a 17, they must take a card. They're forced to take a card. If they have anything 17 through 21, then they can't take a card. I'm going to slightly simplify the rules. Some of you, if you know the game, you may realize that, there's what's called a soft 17 with an ace. I'm going to ignore that. But just, you know, roughly speaking, if you have if the dealer has anything from 17 to 21, they have to stay. So if you have 20 and they have 19, they can't draw another card just hoping to beat you. Okay. They're stuck. They're going to lose. Okay. The player always goes first and sort of takes cards until you're done, and then the dealer follows their rules and draws cards until they either get something between 17 and 21 or go over 21. Okay. If you go over 21 initially, the dealer doesn't do anything. You just lose your money. Okay. So any questions about the game so far? Okay. So let's sort of idealize the situation and imagine we're just betting a dollar each time. So obviously, in making decisions whether or not you want a card or not, it would be nice to know what is left in the deck. I hope that's obvious, right? So if, for example, you know that lots and lots of tens have already gone by, then you might be more likely to take another card or hit if you have a 12. Because since so many tens have gone by, you're maybe a little bit less likely to get a 10, so it makes you more likely to want to bet with a 12. So what card counting involves is trying to keep track of that. So the term card counting, I think, is a little bit misleading because you're not really, I mean, you are doing some counting, but you're not doing anything like Rain Man counting every card or anything. You're not attempting to keep track of actually what cards have gone by. What you're trying to keep track of is, on some level, have more high cards come out so far or have more low cards come out. And so that's what you're trying to keep track of, is this comparison versus high cards versus low cards. So there are many card counting systems with different levels of complexities. What I'm going to do now is the simplest, which is called a high-low system, which is what I used back in the day. I did a very small amount of card counting. I went 3 to 5 times, I think. And, you know, counting cards. I'll tell you a little bit about my story in a second. But let me just. What this system does is it counts anything from 10 through ace as -1, and anything from 7 to 9 is 0, and anything from 2 to 6 is +1. So what you do when you have this card counting system is that you keep a running count in your head of what is going, you know, if you see a 10 jack and ace come, then your count so far is -3. You just sort of add up those numbers, that, you know, you convert these into these and then add them up as you go. You might notice that it's balanced in the sense that there are 5 cards worth -1, 10 jack, queen, king, ace, 5 cards worth +1. And then 3 cards that are zeros. So when you get to the end of the deck, the count should be 0, okay? Which sort of means that it's kind of balanced. So as you proceed through the deck, if the running count is negative, that means that lots of high cards come out. That means that you're a little bit more aggressive in taking cards. And if the running count is positive, that means that lots of high cards are left. So you're going to be more hesitant to take cards because they might, you know, make you go over. So that gives you a decision-making advantage over the house, which they have these specific rules. Yeah? No. So multiple decks doesn't really affect this. Multiple deck just means that you have to keep track longer, right? It's still the same idea that, you know, the deck's still, you know, even if they're multiple decks, they're still balanced. They still have... Each deck has 5 of these, 5 of these, you know. I mean, I think it's 20 of these. 5 times 4, because there are 4 of each of them. 20 cards worth -1, 20 cards worth +1, and 12 cards worth 0. So multiple decks doesn't really affect the actual counting of the cards. But it affects... So, I mean, if you practice keeping track of multiple decks... actually isn't that much harder. You just have to keep track for a longer time. So I think there's this common misconception that, like, multiple decks makes your life a lot harder. What makes your life harder is that two things. There are 2 reasons why the house uses multiple decks. One is that your decisions are going to be different with multiple decks. So let me say a word about that in a second. The other thing is that what you're interested in, like what you're exploiting as a card counter, is the dependence between the draws, right? If the draws were done with replacement, card counting wouldn't make any sense, right? If every time, you know, if somehow they gave you a card and then shuffled it back in and gave you a new card, then it wouldn't make any difference. If they shuffled after every hand, it would minimize the advantage for card counters, right? So you might ask, you know, the sort of, I think there's this conception that the casinos don't like card counters, So you might ask, well, why don't they just shuffle the deck after each hand? Well, they actually do like card counters overall. The population of card counters is some mixture of people that are doing it well and some people that are doing it poorly. And there are more people counting cards poorly than there are that you're counting cards well. And so it's actually, there are lots of people that think that they essentially think they have a positive expected value that don't, right? So positive expected value, you know, in the language of our class means that if you kind of made a box model for their play, they have less than a 50% chance of winning, right? The best you can do as a card counter is somewhere, you know, it depends a little bit on the system and how many decks and stuff like that, but it's around like somewhere between 51 and 52% advantage over the house. So that means you have, you know, 51 or 52% chance of winning on each hand if you're playing perfectly, right? So maybe I'll just interject why I stopped was that there are kind of two reasons. One was that I didn't have that much money to be gambling. So you have to be willing to, well, let me say that. So there's that. There's sort of financial resources is one reason why you might not want to count cards. Another reason is that you may or may not enjoy it. So I found that although I like playing games in general, this didn't seem like a game to me. This seemed like a math test that I was taking for hours and hours, and the problems weren't very interesting. I just had to like be able to answer these questions that were sort of computationally, well, not even computationally, well, I had to concentrate, I guess, is the basic idea, is that I couldn't have a lapse of concentration. I had to watch every card. I had to add everything up. But, you know, adding up ones and zeros and negative ones for hours is not really something I would want as a career choice, I guess. Some people enjoy beating the casino enough that it kind of makes up for that boringness in the actual play. Okay, so in terms of financial resources, let me just interject something relevant to the class, which is that if you have a box model with 51 ones and 49 zeros, and you play, say, 100 times, what's going to happen? So your average of the box is 51 over 100. Your SD of the box is roughly a half. You know, this is 51 over 100 times 49 over 100. About a half. This is very much like coin toss, you know, very slightly biased coin toss, right? Actually, I'm sorry, let me do this. I'll do this as negative ones to really make it like net gain, right? So then the average is going to be 51 minus 49 is 2 over 100 or 0.02. And this is going to be 1 minus negative 1, right? So that's going to be about 1. So 100 plays, that means that 100 times that means you're that's $2. SE is about square root of 100 times 1 is $10. Okay, so if you're able to play and, you know, have about a 1% advantage over the house, betting a dollar every time, in every 100 plays you expect to win about $2. That's probably about 2 hours of work. You could probably play about, you know, if the dealer's fast, if you're one-on-one with the dealer, you probably get in about 50 hands an hour or so, okay? So this is about 2 hours of worth of work, making $2. So this is betting a dollar at a time, right? So if you can bet $100 a time, you just multiply everything by 100. So if you multiply 100 by 100 times, then you're making $200 in 2 hours, expected to make $200 in 2 hours, $100 an hour. Okay, so now we're talking. It's sort of, you know, a pretty good wage if you were going to look at it that way. However, the standard error then also goes up by 100 times. So then you're talking about a standard error of $1,000 in 2 hours. So that means you have to be willing to sustain swings of plus or minus $1,000 or so without going crazy, right? or you know, just having to stop. So that's sort of, you know, that's sort of where you're at. If you increase the number of plays enough, you're kind of gaining the same advantage that the casino gains, which is that you're gaining the benefit of the law of averages, right? Which is making the expected value go up faster than the standard error goes up, right? So, you know, if we could increase this to 10,000 plays, I'll leave it at $1 each for now, then this is going to go up to $20,000. Or sorry, it's 100 times. So it's going up to just $200. And so EV is $200. And then this is going to go up by a factor of 10. Factor of 10, right? I'm increasing the number of plays by a factor of 100, so the expected value goes up by 100 times. SE goes up by 10 times. Okay, so that's a little bit more what you would ideally do, right, is get your standard error small compared to your expected value. So you sort of have less risk if you think about it that way, that breaking even is two standard errors away, right? So pretty much... Right, so if you get two standard errors less than what you expect, then you're just breaking even, no big deal, right? You've wasted however much time that is, right? But you know, you haven't lost money at least. Okay, so if we think about this multiplied by $100, so if we're playing $100 per play, then we get to multiply this by 100. So we have now $20,000, and this is a standard error of $10,000, right? So how long does that take? Well, I said that 100 plays is about 2 hours, so that's about 200 hours. So if you're, you know, working 40-hour weeks, that's, what, is that 5 weeks, I guess, of playing 40 hours a week. So, I mean, you can make money at it, but you have to be willing to play a lot, and so you're dealing with that's sort of a little bit of the math behind it. Okay, so any questions about this at this point? Yeah. No, so you're not allowed to bring any devices. They'll kick you out pretty quick. So again, they want card counters in general, but they really want bad card counters. So they don't want to give you, they won't make it too easy on you. Okay, so I'll make two sort of side comments / stories. So the movie 21 is a story about the MIT card counting team, and it's fictionalized. But the basic idea is that what they did is to exploit another kind of characteristic of the game, which is that when the count is very high, that means that lots of low cards have come by. That means it's more likely that you're going to get high cards. When the deck is very, very rich with high cards, it gives a bigger advantage to the player. So this advantage, I think, is somewhere around the order of like 5% or so. Well, it sort of varies depending on what the count is, but sort of a medium high count, you might get an advantage of like 5% or so. So this has two implications. One is that as a player, as just a casual single person by yourself, you would like to bet more money when the count is high and bet less money when the count is low, right? Because you have more of an advantage over the house when the count is high. And it's actually against you in many cases when the count is low. So one thing that card counting books talk about is betting strategies. And one thing that casinos look for is players that are varying their bets in a systematic way. So that's a little bit where the, the conflict between getting caught or not is where it lies, is that typically dealers and especially pit bosses, the people that kind of watch the players, know how to count cards so they can observe your betting patterns and seeing if you're betting in an intelligent way or not, right? In other words, whether or not you're counting cards accurately and just, you know, betting in a way that looks like it's working. right, or ought to work. So that's a little bit about how they tend to catch people, is by observing their betting patterns and how to vary your bets. I've read things that suggest various ways to get around this. One is to vary your bet sizes, but be sort of sloppy about it. So to have your chips seemingly haphazardly stacked in front of you, but have some stacks that have a lot of big chips in them and have some stacks that have mostly small chips, and pick from the stacks depending on the count. Pick, like, you know, 4 or 5 chips from a stack that you know has a lot of high-value chips in it when the count is high. Pick from a stack that has low-value chips when the count is low. And so you're varying your chip count without really seeming to do it in a systematic way, and it's sort of a way that's hard to detect. So there are, you know, little things like that you can do. And you can walk away when the count is low, you know, and then walk away, start gambling on another table. Yeah?
If the count is high, does that mean you would not want to hit once you were dealt the card?
That's right. That's exactly right. So the thing I haven't told you about is how you make decisions at the table, which is that you have to memorize these tables of what do you do in this situation when you have these cards, the dealer has, you know, one card showing. So this table based on, like, your hand, dealer's card, and then in the body of the table it says is a number, and the number basically says if the count is above this number, don't take a if the count is above a certain number, don't take a card, because, you know, how count means exactly what he said. High count means lots of these cards have happened, so lots of these are left, so you don't want to take a card if the count is high. So did I say that right? So if the count is above this number, don't take a card. If the count's below the number, take a card. Okay? It's more complicated than that. The rules, I've told you the bare bones of the blackjack rules. There are also rules about you can do what's called double down, which means you double your bet, but you only get to take one more card, or you can split. If your two cards match, like you have 2 8s or something, you can split your 8s and then play 2 separate hands, each with the same bet. So this is another way of, like, increasing your bet size as you go, and there are tables you have to memorize for under what circumstances to do those things. Okay, so that's sort of the memorizing tables, if you'd spend enough time, you can memorize tables of, like, you know, what's doing in what situation. You can set yourself up with flashcards, and you can memorize it all. Okay, so, you know, everyone's capable of doing that. How reliable you are just depends on how much time you want to spend on it. And I'm not really suggesting that anyone do this, I think it's a little bit interesting to know what card counters are doing, just as a story. Okay, did I answer your question? Yeah. Okay, good. So can you increase your chance of winning if you play with friends? So that gets us into what the MIT team does. So the MIT team, I don't remember their names for the people now, but they have a person sitting at a table betting the same amount of money every time, so it's, you know, pretty inconspicuous, but keeping a count every time. And they're sort of figuring, you know, that person's probably going to break even. That's not the point. What they have then is a person that's kind of lurking, that they call a high roller, which is that person is going to wait for a signal from the person counting cards to say, okay, the count's really high, and their signals tell what the count actually is, so that when the high roller sits down, they know what the count's at, so they know they know how to make their decisions based on those tables and whatnot. So that high roller may be betting, you know, $1,000, $10,000 a bet, okay? But they're betting only when the deck is highly in their favor, okay? So that's the way the MIT team was gaining a big advantage, was that they were, this is kind of an artificial way of varying the bet size a lot, right? That would be really conspicuous if someone just sitting by themselves did that, like, you know, 3 or 4 times an hour, all of a sudden they're betting, like, $10,000 or something. Would look pretty strange, and it would be conspicuous, and the pit bosses would be able to tell that they're doing that when the count's really high, right? So the behavior of placing, you know, 1 or 2 really big bets is not so infrequent that it's conspicuous at casinos. Okay, so you might have some people with a lot of money that might do that. That might, you know, just bet 3 or 4 hands, a lot of money, because they have a lot of money, and it's, you know, that's really exciting. So, you know, that's what the MIT team did. Yeah, so that a little bit gets into also financial resources. So the players were, I don't know if it's largely or entirely MIT students or, you know, recent grads or whatever, but they were bankrolled. They had money coming in from investors. So there were investors that were saying, you know, you have sort of a proven track record once they had done it for a little while, and we're going to give you a way of betting, you know, $10,000 consistently, doing it, you know, however much, and making more money off of it. Okay, any questions about that? Okay, so this didn't really have anything to do with me stopping, but I did get banned from a few casinos, which it wasn't, so it was actually sort of, I think, for a stupid reason, which is that my friend and I we went together, and we usually tended to not play together at the same table, but we just were, I mean, for no good reason. And we were following the same rules, basically, of how we were varying our bets and whatnot. And this bet, I've never seen this bet anywhere before, but this one table had this, or one of the casino had this side bet you could make on whether or not the dealer's whole card, the face-down card, whether or not that card was above an 8 or below an 8. So if you're counting cards, you know almost exactly when that's a good, you know, bet one way or the other. You know when lots of 2s and 6s, you know, you know sort of which side you're on, right? So if lots of 2s through 6s have gone by, you know that you should bet that it's going to be above an 8. So that was a little bit irresistible to us. And so we're both making that bet on the side at the same times. And I actually sort of think that they had that bet just to catch card counters. But, you know, whatever. It wasn't, for me at the time, it wasn't like I cared that much about getting thrown out of a casino. Or, you know, I didn't really care that much about getting caught. There are lots of casinos. I hadn't been doing it that much. I didn't really expect to, like, make a career out of it or anything. But anyway, so yeah, so they had some security guards came up behind us and asked us to pick up our chips and come with them. And, you know, if you've seen casino movies, it's sort of true that once you get off the casino floor where all the gambling happens, it is like it's like a hospital or something. It's like everything's just like white and clean, and like it's a very stark contrast once you go behind, like in the back areas, the office areas. Oops, whoa. So they put us in a room for a little while and took our pictures and put them on a wall, and they said, like, so what they can do is they have this kind of right to refuse service to anybody. So they said, if you're ever in any of our casinos, and there's a list of a few casinos, then we'll have you arrested for trespassing. So that's what, like, all they can do. Card counting itself is not illegal. So anyway, that's my little story. Any questions about any of that card counting stuff? Okay, so that's that story. Yeah, so anything else? I guess that's all I wanted to say. Yeah.
Were you allowed to keep your money?
Yeah, I was up about $40. It wasn't like, yeah. They weren't after me for that. And honestly, I don't really know over my limited career if I ended up, I think I ended up about even. Which it was like I say, it was like, I'm not sure anymore. This was, you know, more than 20 years ago, I guess. It was, I think, like 3 to 5 weekends that I went or something. What did I want to do next? Okay, so let's... Okay, so I have a couple of other... I don't know if you think this is less interesting or not. It's kind of less fun, I guess, but... It's interesting, I think. This is I can talk a little bit about work that I did in my PhD research, which is sort of, I don't know, sort of interesting story, I think. So I apologize not for not having a better slide. This is actually from a past lecture that I couldn't find my originals for this particular picture. But this is the relationship between imprisonment and crime. And this is for the United States over this period of time. So actually, is this United States or California? I think this is California. I think I labeled this as, yeah, this is California. So what this is showing you, this is normalized to be the same in 1966. So this isn't like to any, don't really think about the scale, but just think about kind of the pattern. So the lower line that's lower here is imprisonment rate, and the upper line is crime rate. So during this period from 1966 to about 1980, imprisonment rates were pretty stable. These are rates per 100,000, and you know, if anything, I guess went a little bit down. Crime rates are rising throughout that same period, and then we had this policy shift around 1980, where we started dramatically putting lots and lots of people in prison. So this is data through, I think, like 2002, something like that. And it's a little bit plateaued since then. But you can kind of see in the picture that, you know, you have these two stories, right? You have the story that when we keep the imprisonment rate the same or lower, then crime rate goes up. And then when we change our policy and, like, put lots and lots of people in prison, the crime rate looks like it's pretty stable. So out of this kind of data, you might think there might be a causal relationship, right? So that's sort of what you would hope, is that you can think about a causal relationship. It's not a well-run experiment, I'll say. It's a little bit of a natural experiment in the sense that this policy shift is, it's like, you know, it's changing something dramatically, and so you might expect, like, in one particular year or something, if you took 10,000 criminals off the street, you could look at the effect of that and see if the crime rate changed. It sort of relies on there not being confounding variables, right? So it relies on there not being other variables that might explain this change. So that's some of the work of a social scientist or a statistician working in the social sciences, is to try to figure out what are possible confounding factors and kind of what can we get out of this. So you can do a lot of different things. Other researchers have done a lot of different things. So a lot of what I was doing in my thesis research was to look at what other people had done and critique it and see if it could be improved. So there was one fairly famous paper that came out of this data in the late 90s that suggested that the number of crimes avoided per person imprisoned was about 17. And it's so the crimes they're talking about, the crimes we're discussing, is what are called FBI index crimes. It's murder, rape, robbery, assault, burglary, larceny, and auto theft are the 7 index crimes. So, you know, they're varying degrees of, I don't know, importance, whatever. So if you're avoiding 17 of them, then it's probably a good idea to put more people in prison. Like, so the decision you're making is, like, as a policy, if you're putting more people in prison, what it means is that you are sentencing people on the kind of margin of crime seriousness more severely, right? So you're tending to put those people in prison and not parole them. The people that are the very serious violent offenders are not really going to be changed by are not going to really be affected by a change in policy. You're presumably going to keep them in prison anyway. So, you know, if they're murderers and rapists and assaulters, this is sort of the violent crimes we're talking about, and robbery, those people presumably are going to be more. Those aren't the people we're talking about. So when we're talking about the 17 crimes, we're mostly talking about larceny and burglary. Those are the crimes that we really expect to decrease by a change in policy like this. And this crime rate is everything wrapped together, but it's dominated by larcenies and burglaries. That's by far what most of these crimes are that we're talking about. So in that context, it's a little bit reasonable, I think, to make economic decisions about this. And we can sort of evaluate the dollar amount of what these people are stealing compared to the dollar amount of putting them in prison as a society, right? Now there's also sort of a danger factor in a sense that, you know, you don't want your stuff to get stolen. Even if as a society, it sort of balances out. Does that make sense? Like if as a society, a person is stealing $35,000 worth of stuff a year and we can put them in prison for $35,000, probably we want to make the decision to put them in prison, right? If it's sort of a balance, we'd probably rather not have our stuff stolen, right? Okay, so any questions about that part of it? Okay, so my take on the past research is that the number of 17 is inflated for a variety of reasons. The most important of which, in terms of just like how much it affects that number, is that they include unreported crime in that number. So unreported crime is a little bit different in its characteristics than reported crime. Unreported crimes tend to be less severe in the sense that they're more often property crimes and more often less, you know, not as much money, stuff that was stolen that wasn't worth much money. It's cases where more often the thing stolen was stolen by someone known to the person it was stolen from, and more often stolen by a family member, and that's the reason why it wasn't reported. However, the reason why we know about them is we take surveys, we sample people, and we ask them questions like, did you have anything stolen, how much was it worth, things like that. So we have some idea of, we can compare the numbers from surveys to the actual numbers that of things that are reported to police. So anyway, there's some other more technical reasons why the 17 is an overestimate, but my take on it is the number is more like 5, and it is mostly property crimes, larcenies and burglaries, and it probably, you know, economically overall, it doesn't make sense for us to be putting a lot more people in the prison just from an economic standpoint, especially now, right? So there's some amount of diminishing marginal returns in all this. So the additional people you're putting in prison in 1980 are different than the additional people that you're putting in prison in 2000 or in 2010, because once you've this is more than tripling the imprisonment rate. So you put away a lot of the more serious, even property offenders. The people that you're putting away now are people that are committing fewer and fewer crimes. It's sort of, you know, harder and harder to find those people that are really economically worthwhile to put in prison, you might put it that way. So for a few reasons, I think the evidence suggests that from an economic standpoint, probably doesn't make sense to put as many people in prison. If you want to look at it that way. Any questions about any of that? Okay, so maybe that's not as interesting as counting cars. So, sorry. The other one I wanted to talk about is abortion rates and crime. So this is a story that's told in the book Freakonomics, which has sort of been popularized. And the picture I'm showing you now is abortion rates per 1,000 for age 15 through 44 before Roe v. Wade and after Roe v. Wade. So there's this kind of this break point. Roe v. Wade is 1973. So Roe v. Wade legalized abortion nationwide. Abortion was already legalized in 5 states. One of them is California. One of them is New York before that point. So this here represents the abortions that happened in the states where it was legalized prior to 1973. Before 1970, I guess it wasn't legalized anywhere. So the abortion rate is presumed to be zero. So the sort of plausible story that Freakonomics tells is that we have this big jump in the number of abortions, and if you, so this is 1973, right? So this is looking at this picture here. How old are people when they start committing crimes? Well, maybe around 18 to 24. So if we look later than that, so 1973 plus 18 is the 90s. So here, to really see it, you need to look a little bit farther, which is the crime rate did go down during the during the later 90s. So what the story is that essentially in 1973, let's think about it in sort of a purely non-emotional way. But what we did starting in 1973 is we started literally removing from the population unwanted children, right? So that's how you think of if you have more abortions, you're having fewer kind of literally unwanted children in your population. So the thought is that unwanted children grow up to be criminals, or they're more likely to grow up to be criminals, okay? And you can think about this in a variety of ways. Maybe it's because they're unwanted, or it may be because of demographic characteristics of the people that get abortions, okay? So there are, in general, the mothers that have abortions tend to be of lower socioeconomic standing than people who don't have abortions. And you can kind of think of that in more than one way. That may be just because of people of lower socioeconomic standing tend to have more unprotected sex, or you can think of it as women progress through their lives, they prefer to have children when their financial situations are better. So when their personal financial situation is not as strong, they may tend to say, oh, you know what, I'm going to have an abortion now, and then maybe I want to have kids five years later. Okay, so it's a matter of some aspect of the choice is mothers choosing to have babies when they have better socioeconomic standing, when they have more money, and some of it is just individuals who have abortions tend to be people who are, you know, more likely poor unwed teen mothers in general. Okay, so that's the story, is that by removing these unwanted children from the population starting in 1973, we should expect to see a drop in crime starting about 18 years later or something, as we have a population of possible criminals that doesn't have these kids in it, then maybe we'll have less crime. So the kids that are growing up earlier are, have more unwanted kids, maybe more criminals in them. So that's the story. The main criticism I have to that story is that the data is extremely poor quality. And it's extremely poor quality right where you want it to be good. You really want to have good data right here. But what this data assumes is that the abortion rate is zero whenever it's illegal, which is sort of clearly false. Yeah. That's, no. That's one way to say it, yeah. There are certainly, so there were, before 1973, there were certainly a lot of abortions performed. That is maybe the lowest cost, but you could also get abortions from doctors that were willing to perform them illegally. There are lots of abortions being performed. You could also go to a state where they were legal. So it was sort of a famous thing. There was a sort of term at the time that women would talk about going to New York for the weekend as a code for getting an abortion, because they're legal in New York but illegal in New Jersey. So one thing that happened that was sort of interesting at that time was that abortions went down in New York dramatically because people were no longer coming to New York to get abortions. So you know that, especially in the states around New York, you know that the abortion rate was not zero before that time. So the data is not that great. What you really want is like the state of residence, where the where the women were from, and then you can do a little bit more of a reasonable comparison of what's going on. And it's very detached, also, right? It's you know, the kids where the abortion rate. So what you're interested in particular is the difference between the states where it was legalized before and the states where it was legalized later, and kind of contrasting those. But people move. It's 18 years later, right? So it's a little bit hard to figure out. And so that's one criticism I have of the way that the analysis was done. So I'll just say there's some other maybe more technical reasons why I think the analysis is flawed. Having said that, I think it probably is, I think it's actually a true story. I just don't think that the statistics is a very strong argument for it. The statistics is not that kind of robust. What we're talking about here, the reason why I think it actually, just as a human, I think it's a good story, and I think it's probably true, is that we're actually talking about a lot of abortions. It's like hundreds of thousands of abortions. So I think you can't, having that shift of, hundreds of thousands of abortions per year after 1973 that weren't happening before 1973, I think it's got to have some effect on your population, right? So I think it is reasonable to think that it, there are going to be differences in the people born, in the population of people born after that and the people born before. So anyway, that's my take on it, is that I think it's probably a true story, but I don't think the data is very good at proving that. Okay? Any other questions, comments? Yeah. So she was talking about like two different factors that maybe made crime decrease. Were you talking about increased imprisonment rate and abortion as those two things? So what you want to look at is you want to look at it as possible as like mini experiments, and look at years when the crime rate when the imprisonment rate went up most dramatically. Like if it went up by 10% in one year and only up by 3% in a different year, the year it went up by 10%, you should expect to see right after that a bigger change in crime rates. Okay, so looking not only at the trend over time, but just year by year, trying to disentangle that. And with abortion, it's a little bit. So the analysis they did is actually, so there's a couple kind of smart things they did was that they sort of looked at the people that are most like the age groups that are most likely to commit crimes, and what was the abortion rate like in the year they were born. So in like 1990, for example, they would look at the proportion of crimes committed by 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds and so forth, and then look back at what was happening the year that those ages were born. And if the abortion rate was very high kind of overall for the people that are likely to commit crimes, then that's what they sort of think as their variable, is this kind of weighted abortion rate based on those birth years. So it's looking at it kind of small scale and not looking at these kind of broad trends, but looking at for particular years, do we see what we would expect, essentially? If we believe the story that this is caused by increased imprisonment rates, the years that imprisonment rate is increased a lot, we should expect to immediately see a benefit. So to what extent that happens. And those are correlated. It does seem like there's a little bit of an effect, but I think the magnitude is probably not as big as 17. I think it's more like 5 is like my contribution, I guess. So any other questions, thoughts? Okay. All right, cool. Thanks for coming. Have a good break. And see you when we get back. So we're starting chapter 21 when we get back.